You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
It's budget season, and if you're wondering, wait, didn't we just have one recently? Yes, indeed, we did have one recently, but that was the interim budget in an election year. Now that the NDA has got its thumping mandate, it's time for the real deal. The first union budget in NDA 2.0 and the first one by Nirmala Sitharaman, the freshly minted finance minister. But before we launch into the nitty-gritties of the matter, a quick history lesson. In historical terms, the annual budget is a fairly new invention, by the way. The origins of the budget exercise, though, lie in kings and queens behaving badly and spending and overspending like kings and queens. The Telegraph noted, and I quote, "The office of the Treasurer," this is in the United Kingdom, "began life within that of the Exchequer, which was responsible for managing the royal revenues and for issuing and collecting cash. Having been established at the time of the Norman invasion in the 11th century, the Exchequer did not reform until the reign of Elizabeth I. Following those reforms in the 1580s, a deficit was quickly turned into a surplus." Unquote. Now that sounds promising, you think kings and queens getting their act together. But it did not take long for future kings and queens to squander away the country's tax revenues and rack up mountains of debts. Charles II landed the country's finances in such a mess that the Dutch managed to seize the Royal Charles, which was the Navy's flagship, in 1667. It was this humiliation which prompted another spate of reforms and the establishment of the principle that even if Parliament has approved of expenditure, it needs the approval of the Treasury. Now, that is a rule that still stands today in Britain. It was not until the early 18th century that a version of the annual budget emerged. While at first referring only to the Chancellor's annual speech on the country's finances, the word quickly became used for any financial statement or plan. So, what you and I do on a monthly basis is also a budget. The bursting, for example, of the South Sea bubble in 1720 wrecked the country's balance sheet and led to the imprisonment of the Chancellor in the Tower of London. Toward the end of the same century, in 1789, Pitt the Younger introduced income tax. And that, of course, changed the way the budget was written and executed. And the British, of course, brought this exercise to India. The Union Budget in India is, of course, the annual financial statement of expenditure and receipts of the Government of India for the financial year, and it is required by Article 112 of the Constitution. But like any budget, yours or mine, what we need to also understand is how much money there is and how much of it can be spent and on what. And these are among the questions that we will attempt to address today. What is the source of income for this massive joint family that is India? How does India make its money? On this edition of Digging Deeper, that is among the questions we will ask. A question aunties and uncles before making any marital alliance for their children ask. What is the source of your income and how do you intend to spend it? The word budget is often said to be derived from the old French word for a little bag or purse. But there's a little more to it than meets the eye. As the Oxford English Dictionary points out, the phrase to open one's budget was being used in the 16th century to mean that someone was revealing something that was secret, perhaps even dubious. It meant something like bringing out a box of tricks. On this edition of Digging Deeper, let's find out what goes in and comes out of this box of tricks. My name is Rakesh Sharma, and you're listening to Money Control,
the Deep Dive podcast series.
First, let's show you the money. The Indian government, like most others in the world, earns money, that is, gets its revenues, by collecting taxes from citizens and corporations and on goods and services. The receipt budget, which lays down the details of the sources of earnings, is also part of the budget presentation. As DNA reported last year, this is the breakup of the source of our monies. 19% of the rupee comes from corporation tax, 16% from income tax, 9% from customs duty, 14% from excise duty, 10% from service tax and other taxes, 10% non-tax revenue, 3% non-debt capital receipts, 19% from borrowing and other liabilities. I'll break down some of those items as we go further into the podcast. Now, if you've bristled at the thought of a poorly maintained road or irregular electricity supply and screamed into the void, "I pay taxes, I deserve better," you are right, of course, you do deserve better. But know also that your taxes count for less than a fifth of the country's collective income, at just about 16%. In 2017-2018, the government gained 15.15 lakh crore rupees in revenue receipts and about 6.3 lakh crore rupees in capital receipts, taking the total to about 21.5 lakh crore rupees. That's how much money India made in that fiscal year. Broadly considered, the government makes money through tax revenues, non-tax revenues, and capital receipts. Let's find out what each of those is. Here, we have to understand something called gross tax revenue. It comprises of the following components. These are, of course, FY18 estimates. Corporation tax, that's about 5.38 lakh crore rupees as of last year. Tax on income, 4.41 lakh crore rupees. Customs duty, that's about 2.5 lakh crore rupees. Excise duty, about 4.06 lakh crore rupees. And service duties, that's about 4.75 lakh crore rupees. So you don't have to memorize those numbers, just know these headings. Corporation tax, customs duty, excise duty, tax on income, and service duties. Of course, starting last year, we've had the goods and services tax, which has replaced the excise and service duties. The share of the income tax contributing to the GTR is also coming down progressively. In the year 2015-2016, corporation tax made 31% and income tax made 20.5% of the total tax revenue collected by the government. In 2016-2017, corporation tax 21%, income tax 14% of the total tax revenue. So that's one stream of income for the country, gross tax revenue. What about non-tax revenues? These come from the money earned by the government other than the tax routes, as the name would have it. The largest chunk of these is collected from profits and dividends of public sector undertakings, that is PSUs, including, you know, PSU banks, RBI, etc. For FY18, the non-tax revenue collected by the government from PSUs and the RBI was about 1.45 lakh crore rupees. Revenue collected from sale of spectrum forms the second largest part of the non-tax revenue. The remainder of this non-tax revenue is collected from royalty on inland petroleum, tolls collected from national highways, interests, etc. Non-tax revenue constitutes about 11% of the total receipts. And then we have the third one, that is capital receipts. Collection of capital receipts come from borrowings and other liabilities. The largest part of capital receipts is collected from market loans. The rest of it is collected from recovery of loans, disinvestment, small savings securities, external debt, and others. Capital receipts formed about 26% of the total receipts as of FY18. And then there are proceeds from divestment in public sector enterprises. The Economic Times reported only recently that the government raised a record 77,417 crore rupees from sale of its stake in public sector units in 2018. The disinvestment program is headed for another blockbuster year in 2019, with now the planned privatization of national carrier Air India. We failed at it last year. We're trying it again. So those are the sources of the income of the country. This joint family that is India obviously has several earning members contributing to the coffers. But who is the top earner? As a useful side note, let's take a look at the contributions of various sectors in the country to its GDP. Agriculture, predictably, was the highest earner, but the contribution from agriculture has come down over the years. 17% of the country's GDP was contributed by agriculture in 2017. Chemicals are a big business in this country. Reliance, one of the country's largest companies, has a petrochemical refinery as one of its most important components. The chemical sector contributed about 2.11% to the Indian GDP in 2016. The petrochemical industry contributes approximately 30% to India's chemical industry, which is expected to become a $250 billion industry by 2020. India's mining industry made up over 2.6% of the country's GDP in 2015-2016. Direct and indirect activities related to tourism are also big contributors to the country's GDP, with them adding 9.6% of the country's GDP in 2016. The star of the show, though, since the economic reforms of 1992, is the services industry. As Investopedia noted, and I quote, "Over the past 60 years, the service industry in India has increased from a fraction of the GDP to over 55% in 2018. India, with its high population of low-cost, skilled, English-speaking, educated people, is a great place for doing business. IT companies contributed almost 8% of the country's GDP in 2016. So as we've established, the government is basically a very large joint family. Think the Viranis from Kyuhi Saas Bhi Kabhi Bahu Thi, except not just Gujaratis, but also Tamilians, Kannadigas, Maharashtrians, Bengalis, etc., etc., basically everybody in the country. Not to forget that this joint family's population is, well, 1.3 billion people. A billion, just for our revision's sake, has 9 zeros. And for some more mind-boggling context, all of Europe, an entire continent, has 743 million people. That is over 40 countries and about half the population of India. Even all of Africa does not have 1.324 billion people. So basically, the expense account of this joint family is continentally monumental. So how do we do it? When planning a ghar ka budget, we have to first take care of the essentials, right? Dal roti khane hai, prabhu ke gun bhi gaane hai. But can we have caviar this month, or is it for next month or ever? Can we go on holiday this month, or do we have to go on holiday this month? Can this wait? Does Pintu need IIT coaching, or are his college classes okay, just enough? Should we upgrade the car, or is the old one okay with some re-upholstering? These are the questions mummy papa think of when they're planning the budget. So just like our parivar, the finance minister's parivar also has to think of all these things, except her parivar is the entire nation. The first order of business in this household, as in any other, is prioritizing. The government has to set aside funds for infrastructure, welfare schemes, subsidies and salaries, among many, many other requirements for the batti of this household to keep burning. Which brings us to the important question of, paise kahan se aate hai, tumhara baap dega? Well, in the nation, we're all each other's baps. The taxes we pay, the earnings we as a nation make, take care of the rest of us. And how do we spend it? That's what the budget is all about. There are two ways in which the money is allocated. We are now talking about spending streams. I already told you how we get the money. Now, this is the part where we talk about how we spend the money. There are spending streams. The government spending is listed under two heads. One of them is called revenue expenditure and the other, capital expenditure. Now, if they seem like big words you see in a macroeconomics textbook, it is because, well, they are. We here at Money Control are here to simplify them for you. First, revenue expenditure. Now, this is the amount spent on day-to-day running of departments, interest payments, subsidies, and salaries. In the Hindustani joint parivar, a la the Viranis, except we have a Smriti sitting there in the cabinet already, revenue expenditure translates to spending on the basics of day-to-day living. Roti, kapda, makan, bijli. People who work for the government also need to be paid, no? So this all comes from revenue expenditure. Now, the second stream is capital expenditure. This is the money spent on creating assets and investments in land, machinery and projects. This is like the mother of the joint parivar saying, chalo kuch gold bhi khareed lete hai is bar, kyunki chameli ki shaadi jab aayegi, tab istemal ho jayega. It is essentially planning for the future. Buying a house, let's say, should I buy it in Bandra or should I move a little further to Andheri or perhaps Versova is all I can afford, but really can I even afford a house at this point, etc., etc. These lines of thinking all fall under capital expenditure. And finally, a quick look at how big the Hindustani joint parivar budget has gotten. In 2004-2005, the size was about 50,000 crore rupees. And in a swift span of 13 years, take a guess as to where it might be. Double? Triple? Bhai, we have gone fourpul. The right word is also not coming from my mouth because we have just about quadrupled the size. Bhaiyo aur behno, it is about 200,000 crore rupees in total expenditure. Bhai, can you imagine how much toor dal is required for this family? 1.324 billion people. It's a good thing I don't know how to make even dal. It's all mummy's problem. Or in this case, it is Nirmala Sitharaman's. Something tells me I am not jealous of her job. So, we know how we make the money. We know how we plan to spend the money. And how do we go about doing it? Let's find out. In between, I have to also tell you something about fiscal deficit. This is one side note. Have you ever thought of how the government makes ends meet? If this was a Hindi film, considering we're talking about the joint parivar and Viranis, etc. If this was a Hindi film from the 1970s and the family found itself in a bit of a tight spot, you know what Nirupa Roy would do, right? She would take the kangan that was the family heirloom and beg Pran, who is the moneylender, the evil one, to save her family from destruction. Pran would be super mean to her, and looking from a corner would be one young boy who is seething in rage and gritting his teeth, and the next frame cuts to Nirupa Roy crying, and the next frame cuts to even more seething young boy, and then there's music, and the next frame is Amitabh Bachchan in bell bottoms doing some more seething. But the point is, that is how Nirupa Roy used to bridge the deficit in that family. The fiscal deficit is basically a measure of how much the government, or in this case Nirupa Roy, borrows annually. The government has set a fiscal deficit target of 3.4% of the GDP for FY20. But how does the government do the same? How does it bridge this deficit? There are several ways. Market loans. The government raises loans from the market by bonds. The RBI auctions these bonds on the government's behalf, and financial institutions and banks mostly buy these bonds. Simple enough. Number one, market loans. Next, we have treasury bills. Nope, this has nothing to do with Buffalo Bill or Bill Cosby or Bill Clinton or the rhinoceros horn bill. Have you seen that bird? It looks damn weird. But treasury bills are not. For temporary cash flow, the government issues short-term treasury bills or bonds. These bonds have maturities of 364 or 182 or 91 days. So market loans, treasury bills, and small savings. The government, let's call her Nirupa Roy for this installment, also borrows money from individuals through savings schemes. Post office savings, NSC, that is your National Savings Certificate, public provident funds, etc., are some examples of such small savings. These are all pooled under the NSS fund or the National Small Savings Fund. And it could also be temporarily used for bridging the deficit. And that is precisely what the fiscal deficit is and how the government bridges it. So I'm hoping by now you understand where the money comes from, where it goes and how it is allocated, etc. Now, the writing and the printing of the budget itself is the topic of our next act. It stands to reason that the making of a magnum opus, such as the Union Budget, is a fairly long-drawn process. Rome wasn't built in a day. Lagan wasn't made in a day. And don't we all know that the making of Lagan is in itself a feature film-length documentary? So the budget is also essentially the making of Lagan. It is all about taxes, isn't it? It takes a village to raise a child, said Hillary Clinton in her book, What Does It Take to Raise the Union Budget? Seemingly a ballet company and a juggling act, because it has to juggle political pressures, the country's economic priorities, and the needs and wants of the most important component of the budget, the people of the republic. So how is this done? Act 1, a circular is sent. In a normal non-election year, Act 1 begins as early as August. A circular is sent to the various ministries and departments. Think of it as a large joint family, again, and the matriarch, Nirupa Roy, or finance minister in this case, sending the grocery book to the rest of the family. Pintu wants almonds because he thinks they will make him smarter. Bunty wants whey protein because he thinks it'll make him hotter. Different priorities, different needs, different ministries, different requirements of cash. These ministries and departments fill the circular with details of the funds they need, and the circular returns to the mother, or in this case, Nirmala Sitharaman. That ends Act 1. Act 2, consultations are made. Consultations. If you've seen Game of Thrones or any show with palace intrigue and courtier dealings, then you get a sense of Act 2 of the making of the budget. Ministry officials meet industrialists, farmers, labor unions, and other groups that have a contribution to make to the drafting of the document, the details of which affect, obviously, all walks of society. So all stakeholders, so to speak, need to be met with. The finance minister then chairs final meetings with stakeholders. If you want parallels from history or entertainment, or well, historical entertainment, think Lord Varys or Oliver Cromwell, and you start getting an idea of who the main players of Act 2 are. But it's not just the protagonist of the show, that is Mrs. Sitharaman, it's all the officials in the ministry and the powers that be in the country. In my vivid imagination, Act 2 involves dark rooms with mahogany furniture covered in smoke and, you know, secret and with stoic discussions about what to do and what not to do, etc. But it probably is more like the conference room you and I know and involves the Excel sheets you and I hate. So a lot of Excel sheets. That is basically Act 2. In Act 3, we move on to the quarantine. The details of this act could put any political thriller to shame. This is the act of the quarantine. You may have encountered the term quarantine only in relation to diseases like bird flu or swine flu, but here we are enforcing quarantine in the making of the Union Budget. Officials, stenographers, technicians, anyone who may have access to the details of the document are quarantined at North Block's basement. They are cut off from the outside world for 7 whole days. It's a sort of a big boss situation. And funnily enough, these officials will have to wait 7 whole days to find out what happened on the actual big boss. No Facebook, no Instagram, no Snapchat, no internet. All I imagine now are horrified faces of 20-somethings. It's a good thing that the average age there is probably not the 20s. The intrigue gets even more intriguing. Intelligence Bureau officials monitor movements and phone calls of these members. A phone jammer is installed to block calls and prevent leakages. It all sounds a bit cloak and daggery. The background music for Act 3 is probably a Hans Zimmer score or something. It's tense and it's hectic and you're cut off from the world. And in the final act, just before the speech is made, the printing of the speech. The finance minister's speech. It doesn't quite have the ring of the king's speech, does it? Nevertheless, this speech, the climactic act of the making of the budget, is among the most closely guarded documents in Indian politics. It is a culmination of the months of work by hundreds of people. The printing of the speech starts at midnight, 2 days before the budget. It's printed in the basement of North Block on Raisina Hill, the same North Block where so many officials were quarantined for 7 days. The background score to this final act? Well, a lot of sighs of relief, I'm guessing, and hopefully some champagne bottles being popped. There was blood, there was sweat, there were tears, and hopefully there will also be some champagne. Not just for the people behind the making of the budget, but also to all of us, the common men and women, the payer of the lagan. Now that the budget is printed, what next? It needs to be read out. Next part, the budget speech. The annual budget speech is, of course, a showcase event for every Indian government. For the finance ministry, it's the pièce de résistance, the one day in a year where the Vitt Mantri is perhaps more important than the Pradhan Mantri. The budget speech is the one that the finance minister presents after posing with that rather sober-looking, businessy-looking briefcase. The briefcase is an old tradition in itself, like all things Indian. It began with the British finance minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who used a red briefcase way back in 1860. And I guess everybody was very impressed. How else do you explain a red-coloured briefcase becoming so popular? Anyway, India way, the finance ministers were adventurous, changing the colour of the briefcase to brown and even black. British Vitt Mantris, of course, continue to use a red briefcase. Until 1999, budget speeches were presented at 5 p.m. on the last working day of February every year, in keeping with the Indian government's colonial heritage. This was changed in 1999 by Yashwant Sinha, who started presenting the budget at 11 a.m. 2017 onwards, Arun Jaitley has switched to presenting the union budget on the 1st of February. Nobody still knows for sure why. In an election year, an interim budget is presented, and once the government comes to power, an actual budget is presented, which is precisely why we're having it, this time on the 5th of July. The budget determines how money will be handled by the government. Most importantly for us, the annual budget can either augment or diminish our incomes. Millions of people gather around their TV sets or watch on their mobile phones the live telecast of the budget. Yehi wo ek din hai, jab India ka cricket match bhi log ignore marte hai because we all want to know if our ATC exemption limit has been increased and how much our home loan is going to cost us. Or do we have enough funds to go on a 2-week honeymoon trip to Australia? The speech itself is divided into two parts, parts A and B. Wow, counterintuitive. Part A usually contains an overview of the state of the Indian economy, progress report, Himan Lijesko, and the opposition is also there right in front of you, giving their feedback. Opposition parties are rarely ever happy with the state of the economy. I do not know why. Anyway, Part A also contains major economic policies that the government intends to initiate. For example, big-ticket schemes like the many Pradhan Mantri schemes like Avas, Ujwala, Ayushman Bharat, etc., MNREGA, NRHM, Bharat Nirman, etc., etc. These are all announced in Part A of the budget speech. The first half also contains estimates on the government's expenditure as well as on the fiscal deficit, about which we have just spoken. Fiscal deficit is the shortfall where the government doesn't have enough money to spend on its schemes. Part B contains the tax proposals that the government wishes to implement. This includes both direct and indirect taxes. Income tax and customs duty are also covered in Part B. Speaking of indirect taxes, 2018 was the first budget by Arun Jaitley after GST came into effect, so these will also be spoken about. Once the budget is presented, it is the turn of talking heads and analysts and editorials taking over. What was good, what was bad. And then me, coming back tomorrow to explain all that went down in the speech. Just to leave you with a few odds and ends and some trivia about the union budget, the longest budget speech in terms of words was given by Dr. Manmohan Singh in 1991. It had 18,177 words. This was the budget, of course, that tried to liberalize the economy, opening the government and the private sector to international competition. So I guess the verbose nature of the budget was warranted. Arun Jaitley is credited with delivering the second, third and fourth longest budget speeches in 2014. 2017 and 2016 respectively. Jaswant Singh took the longest time, 2 hours and 13 minutes, to present his budget in 2003. H.M. Patel's 800-word interim budget in 1977 had the shortest speech. Morarji Desai's presentation of 10 budgets is the highest delivered by any finance minister, and he's followed by P. Chidambaram, who has presented 9 union budgets. The first budget of independent India was presented for a period of just 7 months. The finance minister at the time, R.K. Shanmugam Chetty, presented it on the 26th of November, 1947. 3 generations of the Gandhi-Nehru family have presented union budgets. Jawaharlal Nehru, Indira Gandhi and her son Rajiv Gandhi presented the budget while serving as prime minister. In 1970, Indira Gandhi became the first woman finance minister to present the budget. In addition to being prime minister, she also held the finance ministry. 2 finance ministers have gone on to hold the highest office in the republic, that is the job of the president of India. And who are these 2 people? R. Venkatraman and Pranab Mukherjee. C.D. Deshmukh was the first Indian governor of the Reserve Bank of India, who later became finance minister and presented his first budget in 1951. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. For a chancellor presenting a budget in the UK, inviting bouquets and brickbats was all part of the game. Perhaps one might allow him the pleasure of a small luxury during such a trying time. Believe it or not, the chancellor there, in recognition of his efforts, because it mostly used to be his when this used to happen, in presenting a budget, was to allow him a drink during this arduous task of presenting the budget. I think it was Gladstone who took about 4.5 hours to present his budget. You would get thirsty. Well, you could drink water, except the Chancellor of the Exchequer was allowed an alcoholic drink back in the day. In a speech which would last hours, any chancellor might get thirsty. And if the minister wants to deliver the budget with an alcoholic drink at his side, he or she can do. It is the only time of the year the rules about drinking in the chamber are suspended, but only for the chancellor. Nigel Lawson used to drink a spritzer, and Geoffrey Howe, who went on to name his dog Budget, would have a gin and tonic at his side. Gladstone, the first user of this red box, would wash down delivery of the budget with sherry and beaten egg. In recent times, the chancellors are not very adventurous. They've all resorted to mineral water. Of course, this practice would not ever be allowed in India. Can you imagine somebody drinking an alcoholic drink in the Lok Sabha? Well, watching some questionable material in the Karnataka assembly is fine, I'm guessing. But drinking? No. We can still admire this gesture, though, that was allowed to the thirsty UK Chancellor. Now, on that, let's raise a toast to the Finance Minister for a job that is done. Is it well done? We'll find out tomorrow.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast. And you have been listening to Money Control.